But in the ensuing dialogue, Juan Diego was told that the girl was Mary, and that she desired a temple at that particular place. So run out at Tenochtitlan, Mexico City, and tell the Lord Bishop all that you have seen and heard. This was easier to say than to accomplish. Poor Indians were not in the habit of going to the Spanish section of the city, and even less to the bishop's palace. Bravely, however, Juan ran down the mountain and begged Don Fray Juan de Zumarraga to hear his story. Naturally, the bishop, although he was kind to the Indian, did not believe a word of his tale, so Juan went back through the mountains and met the lady a second time. He advised her to send the bishop a more suitable messenger, and he was quite frank about it. "Listen, little son," was the answer. "There are many I could send. But you are the one I have chosen for this task. So, tomorrow morning, go back to the bishop. Tell him it is the Virgin Mary who sends you, and repeat to him my great desire for a church in this place." The next morning, Juan Diego returned to Mexico City and met again with the patient bishop. Juan Diego was so adamant and seemed so honest in telling his story that Fray Juan de Zumarraga was shaken. He told Juan to ask the apparition for a tangible sign, and he instructed two servants to follow the Indian and watch his actions. They tracked him through the city, observed that he spoke to no one, saw him climb the hills, and then he vanished. They searched the area without finding a trace of him. The perfect fairy tale. But Juan had gone to the hill. He gave the apparition the bishop's answer, and she said, "Very well, little son. Come back tomorrow at daybreak. I will give you a sign for him. You have taken much trouble on my account, and I shall reward you for it. Go in peace, and rest." The next morning, Juan did not come. His uncle, his only relative, was dying. Juan spent the day trying to relieve his sufferings and left him only on Tuesday, to get a priest. As he was running to Tlaltolco, however, the apparition again barred his way. Embarrassed, he told her why he had not followed her instructions, and she said, "My little son, do not be distressed and afraid. Am I not here who am your mother? Are you not under my shadow and protection? Your uncle will not die at this time. This very moment his health is restored. There is no reason now for the errand you set out on, and you can peacefully attend to mine. Go up to the top of the hill, cut the flowers that are growing there and bring them to me." There were no flowers on the top of the hill, as Juan Diego knew very well. In the middle of December, there could be no flower there, and yet upon reaching the place, he found Castilian roses, their petals wet with dew. He cut them and, using his long Indian cape, his dinner, to protect them from the bitter cold, carried them back to the apparition. She arranged the flowers he had dropped in the wrap, then tied the lower corners of the tila behind his neck so that none of the roses would fall. She advised him not to let anybody but the bishop seconds the sign she had given him and then disappeared. Juan Diego never met her again. At the bishop's palace, several servants made fun of the Indian visionary. They pushed him around and tried to snatch the flowers. But when they observed how the roses seemed to dissolve when they reached for them, they were astonished and let him go. Juan was taken once more to the bishop. Juan Diego put up both hands and untied the corners of crude cloth behind his neck. The looped up fold of the tilma fell, the flowers he thought were the precious sign tumbled out and lay in an untidy heap on the floor. Alas for the Virgin's careful arrangement. But Juan's confusion over this mishap was nothing to what he felt immediately after it. Inside of seconds the bishop had risen from his chair and was kneeling at Juan's feet, and inside of a minute all the other persons in the room had surged forward and were also kneeling. The bishop was kneeling before Juan's tilma, and, as Ethel Cuchelieta remarks, millions of people have knelt before it since, for it has been placed over the high altar in the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe, in Mexico City. The tilma consists of two pieces, woven of maggi fibers and sewn together and measuring 66 by 41 inches. On this gauze material, whose color is that of unbleached linen, a lovely figure can be seen, 56 inches tall. Surrounded by golden rays, it emerges as from a shell of light, clear-cut and lovely in every detail of line and color. The head is bent slightly and very gracefully to the right, just avoiding the long seam. The eyes look downward, but the pupils are visible. This gives an unearthly impression of lovingness and lovablookness. The mantle that covers the head and falls to the feet is greenish-blue with a border of purest gold, and scattered through with golden stars. The tunic is rose-colored, patterned with a lacklic design of golden flowers. Below is a crescent moon, and beneath it appear the head and arms of a cherub. In the 6 years that followed the incident, over 8 million Indians were baptized. In recent times, Sonic 1500 persons kneel before Juan Diego's tilma, still intact with the image's radiant colors, ever day. Juan's uncle was cured. As he was awaiting the priest, too weak even to drink the medicine his nephew had prepared, he saw his room suddenly filled with soft light. A luminous figure, that of a young woman, appeared near him. She told him he would get well and informed him of Juan Diego's mission. She also said, "Call me and call my image Santa Maria de Guadalupe," or so the message was understood. But was this the intended meaning? Following the research of Helen B. CHRCNS, Ethel Cook Elliott suggests that the Indian word used by the apparition was Tetelcatlaxapu, which could be transcribed phonetically as Tiguatlasupe. To Spanish ears, this would naturally sound like Tiguadalupe. But the apparition spoke the same Indian dialect as Juan Diego and his uncle. She even looked like a young Indian girl, and she had no reason to use the Spanish term ascribed to her. Tetelcatlaxapu means stone serpent trodden on. Helen B. CHRCNS assumes that the apparition was thus announcing that she had supplanted Uxmal, whom the Indians had idolized as a feathered serpent. This impressive story contains a magnificent symbolism. Not only does it bring us back, through the stone serpent, to the Maya monuments we discussed at the beginning of this book, but it also reminds us, in several important aspects, of the many talks of fairies we have reviewed: the mysterious, sweet music announcing that the fairy draws near, the flowers, roses once again, that grow in an impossible place, and the sign given to the human messenger, which changes nature as he goes away, like the coals given to human midwives by the gnomes that changed to gold, the numerous similar symbols found in countless talks, and finally, the cosmic symbolism, the crescent moon under the Virgin's feet, as in the lines of Revelation, "And there appeared a great sign in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon was under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. Look but do not touch." It was a very great wonder, a sign, in heaven indeed, the marvelous airship that flew over the United States in the spring of indeed. We cannot help but recall here the words of Lartland in his Science of Fairy Talks: "This gift of an object apparently worthless, which turns out, on the conditions being observed, of the utmost value, is a commonplace of fairy transactions. It is one of the most obvious manifestations of superhuman power." 1897. And the rediscovery of the remarkable wave of reports it generated has provided a crucial missing link between the apparitions of older days and modern saucer stories. On Donald Hanlan's map reproduced with the photographs, all the airship reports have been plotted, with a special sign to denote landings. This map perhaps gives a measure both of the volume of data the students of American folklore have been missing and of the amount of work done in the last 3 years by researchers such as Hanlan, Jerome Clark, and Lucius Farish. The result of their investigations is astonishing. In California, in November, 1896, hundreds of residents of the San Francisco area saw a large, elongated, dark object, which carried brilliant searchlights and was capable of flying against the wind. Between January and March, 1897, it vanished entirely. And suddenly a staggering number of observations of an identical object were made in the Midwest. Earlier in the book, we have seen how Alexander Hamilton described it: a craft with turbine wheels and a glass section with strange beings aboard looking down, a description not unlike that given by Barney Hill. In March, an object of even stranger appearance was seen by Robert Hibbard, a farmer living 15 miles north of Sioux City, Iowa. Illibard not only saw the airship, but an anchor hanging from a rope attached to the mysterious craft caught his clothes and dragged him several dozen feet, until he fell back to Earth. To present in an orderly fashion all the accounts of that period would itself take a book. My object here is only to review the most detailed observations of the behavior of the airship's occupants on the ground. But first, how did the object itself behave? It maneuvered very much in the way UFOs are said to maneuver, except that airships were never seen flying in formation or performing aerial dances. Usually, an airship flew rather slowly and majestically. Of course, such an object, in 1897, ran no risk of being pursued, except in a few close proximity cases when it was reported to depart as a shot out of a gun. Another difference from modern UFOs lies in the fact that its leisurely trajectory often took it over large urban areas. Omaha, Milwaukee, Chicago, and other cities were thus visited. Each time, large crowds gathered to watch the object. Otherwise, the airship exhibited all the typical activities of UFOs, hovering, dropping probes on Newton, Iowa, on April 10, for example, changing course abruptly, changing altitude at great speed, circling, landing and taking off, sweeping the countryside with powerful light beams. The occupants of the airship were as variously described as ARC UFO operators. Several reports could be interpreted to mean that dwarfs were among them, but it was not, to my present knowledge, at least, stated in so many words by witnesses. Alexander Hamilton says that the beings were the strangest he had ever seen, and that he did not care to second them again. I am not aware of any detailed portrait of the creatures by the witnesses in the Leroy case. They were hideous people, two men, a woman, and three children, jabbering together. All the operators who engaged in discussions with human witnesses were indistinguishable from the average American population of the time. This, for instance, is the experience related by Captain James Houghton, described in the Arkansas Gazette as the well-known Iron Mountain Railroad conductor. I had gone down to Texarkana to bring back a special, and knowing that I would have some 8 to 10 hours to spend in Texarkana, I went to Ionian, Arkansas, to do a little hunting. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon when I reached that place. The sport was good, and before I knew it, it was after 6 o'clock when I started to make my way back toward the railroad station. As I was tramping through the bush, my attention was attracted by a familiar sound, a sound for all the world like the working of an air pump on a locomotive. I went at once in the direction of the sound, and there in an open space of some 5 or 6 acres, I saw the object making the noise. To say that I was astonished would but feebly express my feelings. I decided at once that this was the famous airship seen by so many people about the country. There was a medium-sized looking man aboard and I noticed that he was wearing smoked glasses. Li was tinkering around what seemed to be the hack end of the ship, and as I approached I was too dumbfounded to speak. He looked at me in surprise, and said, "Good day, sir, good day." I asked, "Is this the airship?" And he replied, "Yes, sir." Whereupon 3 or 4 other men came out of what was apparently the keel of the ship. A close examination showed that the keel was divided into 2 piles, terminating in front like the sharp edge of a knife-like edge, while the side of the ship bulged gradually toward the middle, and then receded. There were 3 large wheels upon each side made of some bending metal and arranged so that they became concave as they moved forward. "I beg your pardon, sir," I said, "the noise sounds a great deal like a Westinghouse air brake." "Perhaps it does, my friend. We are using condensed air and aeroplanes, but you will know more later on." "Already, sir," someone called out, when the party all disappeared below. I observed that just in front of each wheel a 2-inch tube began to spurt air on the wheels and they commenced revolving. The ship gradually arose with a hissing sound. The aeroplanes suddenly sprang forward, turning their sharp ends skyward, then the rudders at the end of the ship began to veer to one side and the wheels revolved so fast that, one could scarcely see the blades. In less time than it takes to tell you, the ship had gone out of sight. Captain Hooton adds that he could discover no bell or bell rope about the ship and was greatly shocked by this detail, since he thought every well-regulated locomotive should have one. He left a detailed drawing of the machine. We next look at the testimony of Constable Sumpter and Deputy Sheriff McLemore, of Hot Springs, Arkansas, while riding northwest from this city on the night of May 6, 1897. We noticed a brilliant light high in the heavens. Suddenly it disappeared and we said nothing about it, as we were looking for parties and did not want to make any noise. After riding 4 or 5 miles around through the hills, we again saw the light, which now appeared to be much nearer the earth. We stopped our horses and watched it coming down, until all at once it disappeared behind another hill. We rode on about 1/2 mile further, when our horses refused to go further. About 100 yards distant, we saw 2 persons moving around with lights. Drawing our Winchesters, for we were now thoroughly aroused to the importance of the situation, we demanded, "Who is that, and what are you doing?" A man with a long dark beard came forth with a lantern in his hand, and on being informed who we were, proceeded to tell us that he and the others, a young man and a woman, were traveling through the country in an airship. We could plainly distinguish the outlines of the vessel, which was cigar-shaped and about 60 feet long, and looking just like the cuts that have appeared in the papers recently. It was dark and raining, and the young man was filling a big sack with water about 30 yards away, and the woman was particular to keep back in the dark. She was holding an umbrella over her head. The man with the whiskers invited us to take a ride, saying he could take us where it was not raining. We told him we believed we preferred to get wet. Asking the man why the brilliant light was turned on and off so much, he replied that the light was so powerful that it consumed a great deal of his motive power. He said he would like to stop off in Hot Springs for a few days and take the hot baths, but his time was limited and he could not. He said they were going to wind up at Nashville, Tennessee, after thoroughly seeing the country. Being in a hurry, we left, and upon our return, about 40 minutes later, nothing was to be seen. We did not hear or seconds the airship when it departed. In the Chicago Chronicle of April 13, 1897, appeared the following, under the headline "Airship Seen in Iowa, Fontenclouc, Iowa, April 12. The airship was seen here at 8:30 tonight, and was viewed by the whole population. It came from the south cast, and was not over 200 feet above the treetops and moved very slowly, not to exceed 10 miles an hour. The machine could be plainly seen, and is described as being 60 feet in length, and the vibration of the wings could be plainly seen. It carried the usual colored lights, and the working of the machinery could be heard, as also could the strains of music, as from an orchestra. It was hailed, "Burr passed on to the north," seeming to increase its speed, and disappeared. There is no doubt in Fontenelle that it was the real thing, and is testified to by the most prominent citizens, etc. Here the airship, which had appeared to Captain Hooton as a typically mechanical contraption, takes on a more fairy-like appearance. The parallel becomes even more striking in the following report, as pointed out by Hanlon. It is extracted from the April 28 edition of the Houston Daily Post, Merkle, Texas, April 26. Some parties returning from church last night noticed a heavy object dragging along with a rope attached. They followed it until, in crossing the railroad, it caught on a rail. On looking up, they saw what they supposed was the airship. It was not near enough to get an idea of the dimensions. A light could be seen protruding from several windows, one bright light, in front like the headlight of a locomotive. After some 10 minutes, a man was seen descending the rope. He came near enough to be plainly seen. He wore a light blue sailor suit and was small in size. Lee stopped when he discovered parties, at the anchor, and cut the rope below him and sailed off in a northeast direction. The anchor is now on exhibition at the blacksmith shop of Elliott and Miller and is attracting the attention of hundreds of people. "This sounds much too familiar to be taken lightly," comments Hanlon, who reminds his readers of the Sioux City incident, when Robert Hibbard was dragged by an anchor hanging from an airship, and of Drake's and Wilkins's account of two incidents that took place about 1211 AD or earlier. According to the Irish story, they happened in the borough of Clora, one Sunday, while the people were at Mass, a marvel. In this town is a church dedicated to St. Kinnires. It befell that an anchor was dropped from the sky, with a rope attached to it, and one of the flukes caught in the arch above the church door. The people rushed out of the church and saw in the sky a ship with men on board, floating before the anchor cable, and they saw a man leap overboard and jump down to the anchor, as if to release it. Lie looked as if he were swimming in water. The folk rushed up and tried to seize him, but the bishop forbade the people to hold the man, for it might kill him, he said. The man was freed, and hurried up to the ship, where the crew cut the rope and the ship sailed out of sight. But the anchor is in the church, and has been there ever since, as a testimony. In Gervasque of Tilbury's Otis Imperialia, the same account is related as having taken place in Gravesend, Kent, England. An anchor from a cloud ship became fastened in a mound of stones in the churchyard. The people heard voices from above, and the rope was moved as if to free the anchor, to no avail. A man was then seen to slide down the top and cut it. In one account, he then climbed back aboard the ship, in another, he died of suffocation. The Houston Post of April 22, 1897, has a further report. Rockland, Mr. John M. Barclay, living near this place, reports that last night about 11 o'clock, after having retired, he heard his dog barking furiously, together with a whining noise. He went to the door to ascertain the trouble and saw something, he says, that made his eyes bulge out, and but for the fact that he had been reading of an airship that was supposed to have been in or over Texas, he would have taken to the woods. It was a peculiar shaped body, with an oblong shape, with wings, and side attachments of various sizes and shapes. There were brilliant lights, which appeared much brighter than electric lights. When he first saw it, it seemed perfectly stationary about 5 yards from the ground. It circled a few times and gradually descended to the ground in a pasture adjacent to his house. He took his Winchester and went down to investigate. As soon as the ship, or whatever it might be, alighted, the lights went out. The night was bright enough for a man to be distinguished several yards, and when within about 30 yards of the ship he was met by an ordinary mortal, who requested him to lay his gun aside as no harm was intended. Whereupon the following conversation ensued. Mr. Barclay inquired, "Who are you and what do you want?" "Never mind about my name, call it Smith. I want some lubricating oil and a couple of cold chisels if you can get them, and some bluestone. I suppose the sawmill hard by has the two former articles and the telegraph operator has the bluestone. Here is a $10 bill, take it and get us these articles and keep the change for your trouble." Mr. Barclay said, "What have you got down there? Let me go and see it." He who wanted to be called Smith said, "No, we cannot permit you to approach any nearer, but do as we request you and your kindness will be appreciated, and we will call you some future day and reciprocate your kindness by taking you on a trip." Mr. Barclay went and procured the oil and coal chisels, but could not get the bluestone. They had no change and Mr. Barclay tendered him the $10 bill, but same was refused. The man shook hands with him and thanked him cordially and asked that he not follow him to the vessel. As he left, Mr. Barclay called him and asked him where he was from and where he was going. He replied, "From anywhere, but we will be in Greece day after tomorrow." He got on board, when there was again the whirling noise, and the thing was gone, as Mr. Barclay expresses it, like a shot out of a gun. Mr. Barclay is perfectly reliable. The same night, half an hour later, according to the Houston Post of April 26 and reported independently, Joss Rand, "Considerable excitement prevails at this writing in this usually quiet village of Joss Rand, caused by a visit of the noted airship, which has been at so many points of late. Mr. Frank Nichols, a prominent farmer living about 2 miles east of here, and a man of unquestioned veracity, was awakened night before last near the hour of 12 by a whirring noise similar to that made by machinery. Upon looking out he was startled upon beholding brilliant lights streaming from a ponderous vessel of strange proportions, which rested upon the ground in his cornfield. Having read the dispatches, published in the Post of the noted aerial navigators, the truth at once flashed over him that he was one of the fortunate ones, and with all the bravery of Priam at the siege of Troy, sick, Mr. Nichols started out to investigate. Before reaching the strange midnight visitor he was accosted by two men with buckets who asked permission to draw water from his well. Thinking he might be entertaining heavenly visitors instead of earthly mortals, permission was readily granted. Mr. Nichols was kindly invited to accompany them to the ship. He conversed freely with the crew, composed of 6 or 8 individuals, about the ship. The machinery was so complicated that in his short interview he could gain no knowledge of its workings. However, one of the crew told him the problem of aerial navigation had been solved. The ship or car is built of a newly discovered material that has the property of self-sustenance in the air, and the motive power is highly condensed electricity. He was informed that 5 of these ships were built at a small town in Iowa. Soon the invention will be given to the public. An immense stock company is now being formed, and within the next year the machines will be in general use. Mr. Nichols lives at Joss Rand, Trinity County, Texas, and will convince any incredulous one by showing the place where the ship rested. In the Flying Saucer Review, Jerome Clark observes that the 1897 wave indicates the futility of any attempt to divorce flying objects from the general situation in which they operate. This makes the study of such objects infinitely broader than the simple investigation, in scientific terms, of a new phenomenon, for if the appearance and behavior of the objects are functions of our interpretation at any particular time in the development of our culture, then what chances can we have of ever knowing the truth? In Chilsix, Dordogne, France, on October 4, 1954, Mr. Garrett, a man who is regarded as trustworthy by local residents, saw a round flying object, the size of a small truck, shaped somewhat like a cauldron. It landed in his field, and a door slid open. 2 normal men in brown coveralls came out. They looked like Europeans and shook hands with Garrett. Then they asked, "Paris? North?" The poor farmer was so taken aback that he did not answer. The 2 men stroked this dog and flew away. On October 20th, that same year, a 40-year-old Czech worker who lives in France was going to work at 3 a.m. near Onletape, Vosges, when a quarter of a mile from his house he met a heavy-set man, of medium height, wearing a grey jacket with insignias on the shoulders and a motorcyclist's helmet and carrying a gun. The stranger spoke an unknown language. The witness, Laszlo Ujvari Komonate, knew some Russian and tried that language. The man, who spoke in a high-pitched voice, understood him at once and asked, "Where am I?" "In Italy, in Spain." Then he wanted to know how far he was from the German border and what time it was. Ujvari told him it was about 2:30, and the man pulled out a watch, which said 4 o'clock. The visitor then told the witness to move along. Soon, Ujvari came into view of a craft that had apparently landed on the road. It was shaped like 2 saucers glued together, about 5 feet in diameter and 3 feet high. Ujvari came within 30 feet of it, but the unknown individual told him to move away, and soon he saw the object rise vertically, with the noise of a sewing machine. October 12, 1954. At about 10:30 p.m. at Saint-Émeric-d'Herblay, on the Atlantic coast of France, 13-year-old Gilbert Lele was walking around outside, about half a mile away from his parents' home, when he saw, in a pasture, a machine he describes as a phosphorescent cigar. Close to the object was a man wearing a grey suit, boots, and a grey hat. In a familiar gesture, the man put his hand on Gilbert's shoulder and told him in French, "Look but don't touch." In his other hand, the man held a sphere from which purple rays were emitted. Shortly thereafter, he climbed aboard the craft and shut the door with a clapping sound. Gilbert had time to see something like a control console with numerous colored lights on it. The craft rose vertically, made a couple of loops while throwing light in all directions, and vanished. A foggy morning, June, 1968, Argentina. An artist, 70-year-old Benjamin Solari Paravicini, was walking outside when he was confronted by a tall blonde man with clear eyes, who addressed him in an unknown language. Thinking he was some insane character, the witness went on his way, but then he lost consciousness.